filming and vice versa, and then I'll launch into the content. My name is Brian Mittman. I'm a social scientist. I'm based up at the VA at Sepulveda. I've been affiliated with the VA since about 1994. I started at Rand in the health program a long time ago. That's when that picture on the flyer is from. The work that I do started out under the label changing physician behavior. Then at some point it morphed into quality improvement research in healthcare. At some point many of the researchers in the field decided that quality improvement research doesn't sound scientific enough, so the term implementation science became more popular. And at this point, those of you who are familiar with the field know that various labels ranging from implementation science to knowledge translation to research translation or research utilization, that's just a list of four or five of what are probably 10 to 15 labels that are used. Now, that's one of the challenges that we face in the field, is trying to coalesce around a single term and to bring all these diverse and disparate streams of research together, since in many cases we're dealing with the same principles, the same study designs, the same kinds of findings and insights, and yet we publish under different labels, which makes it difficult for us to read each other's work as well as others to find it. So that's the focus of my work. I've been affiliated with the VA, as I said, since the mid-90s, and I now direct something called the Center for Implementation Practice and Research Support. It's basically a technical assistance education research center within the VA's Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, or QERI. During the mid to late 1990s, as VA's healthcare reform and reengineering initiative was picking up steam, reportedly the director of the VA healthcare system sat down with a couple of the directors of VA research programs to ask whether the researchers could contribute more directly to the reengineering of VA reform. And the result of that negotiation was something called the QERI program, and a decision to allocate initially $5 million, it's now up to about $15 million per year of medical care funds to the research program. VA sets its research and healthcare delivery budget separately, or Congress does. So the fact that funds are being taken from essentially physician and nurse funding lines to a research program was somewhat unusual. So our program, though, QERI, is very much improvement and policy and practice oriented, with research and evaluation as a secondary focus. The focus of my center, the mission of my center, is to support that research program by helping provide education and technical assistance in the field of implementation science, a field that many of us would argue is important, that's somewhat, not very well known to many researchers. So my professional goal in some ways, both within VA and outside, is to try to enhance the quantity and quality of implementation research. Basically, we need more of it, and we need it to be better and more useful. And this talk and some other things I've been doing along these lines is part of that broader mission, and that is trying to point out ways in which implementation science is integral to comparative effectiveness research, and to help ensure that CER does benefit from implementation science. So I'll begin with my bottom line, or my main contention or argument, and that is the first half of this slide. Implementation science is integral to comparative effectiveness research, that it's critical for achievement of the CER initiative's goals. And that's the policy and practice goals as well as research. So my goal during this talk is to basically argue and support that argument, and explain why I feel this is the case and explain how. So what I'll do is go through three specific roles for implementation science to point out how it should be better integrated into CER. And here are the three roles, and I'll spend 5-10 minutes or so on each of these. First of all, we need implementation science to support implementation of CER findings. Obviously, CER findings themselves are of little value unless they're adopted and implemented, and the basic argument here is that we need more implementation of CER findings, and in order to achieve that implementation, we need implementation research. The second role for implementation science those of us who are in this field are advocating for greater integration of implementation research activities actually into the CER studies themselves. That we shouldn't be completing CER studies and then sort of throwing them over the wall to the implementation folks, but instead addressing both issues simultaneously. And finally, some of these CER studies that are conducted and advocated involve comparisons of delivery system interventions. These are interventions where the comparative effectiveness studies need to be a bit different from those comparing clinical treatments. And implementation science principles offer some guidance in how to design those studies and how to perform more effective comparisons. So again, I will go through each of these and spend 5-10 minutes discussing each. So beginning with the implementation problem and the existence and basis for implementation research, there are two separate streams of policy and practice discussion that underlie or motivate the field of implementation research. When we talk with folks at NIH and other researchers, we tend to speak about translational roadblocks. When we talk to folks at ARC and Academy of Health and elsewhere, we tend to talk about the quality chasm. And I'll talk about each of these two in turn. Stream one, the implementation gap. This is a discussion that picked up steam during the late 1990s when the AAMC held a clinical research summit and basically identified a number of shortcomings in the clinical research infrastructure and activities within the U.S. This eventually led to the establishment of the IOM Clinical Research Roundtable and then to other activities, including the NIH Roadmap Initiative. The basic argument is that the clinical research enterprise within the U.S., and this is internationally as well, there have been similar discussions outside the U.S., the basic argument is the clinical research enterprise is not as efficient and effective as it needs to be. There are other NIH leaders who have written about this, and as I said, the NIH roadmap was in large part a response to the IOM Clinical Research Roundtable. Now, what does this mean? The basic argument is that basic science findings are not picked up rapidly enough by clinical researchers and don't lead to the development of novel clinical research treatments rapidly enough. That's the so-called translation roadblock one, or translation type one. Translation type two, or the second translational roadblock, basically states that new clinical research findings and innovations are not adopted quickly enough in routine healthcare delivery. So when I say that the clinical research enterprise is not as efficient and effective as it should be, basically the throughput, the flow of ideas along the pipeline from basic science to clinical research to routine implementation and use is very slow. And as a result, we're not benefiting from the results, the fruits of that research. This article by Steve Wolf and Robert Johnson is interesting. They actually, using some simulation and analytic techniques, calculated the net return on investment in terms of benefits to health from investment in development of new innovative drugs. And they focused on Me Too drugs, the drug company or NIH researcher who will spend X numbers of hundreds of millions of dollars developing a new antihypertensive that's 5%, 7% more effective than an existing drug. The results of their calculations show that we would achieve much more by investing in increasing fidelity, taking the innovations in the treatments that we now have and ensuring that they are used more widely. And that would be a much better investment for society than investing in yet more innovations that are not adopted quickly enough and are not taken up to benefit patients. So this is another element of the translational roadblocks and the fact that we don't see an efficient progression of ideas. The second stream, again, is the quality chasm, and I know that you're all very familiar with these reports and these findings, and basically the idea of significant gaps in the quality and outcomes of care within the U.S. There are a number of studies which have compared VA versus non-VA care to show in some cases that VA care is better. And my point in showing these studies is to basically argue that the quality chasms are not inevitable. They can be closed. There is evidence that through a variety of different kinds of approaches, including electronic medical records and performance measurement and feedback and a lot of other things that VA has done, that we can in fact improve quality and close that quality gap. And this is actually a slide which is misplaced. I should have placed it earlier, but this basically shows the two translational roadblocks. And the argument that too much of basic science and too much of clinical research is essentially published and sits on a shelf or disappears into the ether rather than leading directly to improved health. So these are two different policy and practice sets of issues and motivations for the field of implementation research. The basic argument that we don't see enough or fast enough implementation of new findings.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
On that prior slide,
yes.
Has anyone estimated the cylinder of the clinical research? I mean, how much that gets churned out of that really is something new that really could improve health? I mean, there's some X amount of it that isn't that worthwhile.
Sure. And that's the case.
Is there a sense of that?
There is. There probably are numbers. I'm not familiar with any articles, but, you know, and that's even more the case with basic lab research.
Right.
So, you know, essentially I should probably have, you know, three different colors of arrows. We have the results of basic and science research, lab science research, that probably don't have any application at all at any point in the future. Another set of ideas and outputs or products from basic research that do have either immediate or near-term clinical applicability and relevance, and that's basically what I'm capturing by the yellow arrows. But I think in, you know, each case it's a pyramid. Much of what is generated does not have value and only a small portion. So when I argue for increased interest and activity in implementation science, the idea is not to try to, for example, equalize the budget in NIH. We should always have a much larger basic science research program than clinical research program, and a larger clinical research program than health services and implementation research program. And yet, I think most would argue that the pyramid is not steep enough, it's too shallow. Too much of the NIH budget is devoted to basic science. The drug companies, of course, appreciate this because it feeds their pipelines. But we probably could be doing more, especially in the area of health services and implementation research, to achieve the mission of NIH, which is not just to feed the pipelines of the drug companies. So the field of implementation research has arisen to basically respond to this challenge. So implementation research is a scientific study of methods to promote the systematic uptake of research findings into routine practice and to improve the quality and effectiveness of health services. Now, health services is in red because, in fact, implementation science exists across all sectors of the economy and activity. There's implementation research underway in education policy, civil and criminal justice, and so on. So this is, in fact, the definition of implementation research in health. But the same basic theories and principles and study designs and so on apply to implementation research across all those sectors. The second paragraph includes a study of influences on healthcare professional and organizational behavior. The two yellow phrases are basically repeated here and essentially show that the first goal, the major goal or category of goal of implementation, is developing and evaluating implementation interventions or strategies or programs. I think many of us in the field prefer to use the word implementation program rather than intervention, because intervention implies a single specific intervention, such as a drug or a surgical procedure, whereas in fact, for the most part, implementation programs are multifaceted and multi-component. And we should not be evaluating them as a single intervention, but that's the point that I'll come back to. The second goal, though, of implementation research, the second focus, is studying implementation processes, bearers, and facilitators. In some way, this first is sort of the experimental category of research, and this is more of an observational category of research, trying to understand behavior change processes and barriers in order to understand implementation.
Question?
Yes.
Okay, so going back to the previous slide, this is the first time I've seen the phrase implementation science. I'm
right.
Familiar with the translational that precedes it. Is it the case that implementation science is larger than translational in that it includes one and two, whereas translational would just be, for example, number one?
The implementation science is essentially equivalent to translation type two. It's translation of research findings into practice. And I'd launched the journal Implementation Science with some colleagues, and we spent countless hours debating terminology and labels, and eventually decided, and this is a discussion that we've had within VA and within NIH as well. Those of us in the field are, many of us are advocating the use of the word implementation research rather than translation, just to avoid confusion. You know, no matter how much we try to explain the distinction between translation type one and type two, it's too easy to talk about translational research without making it clear what you're talking about. But for the most part, implementation research and translational research, or type two, are one and the same. So let me briefly discuss some goals of implementation research and then move into some of the other roles for implementation research within CER. As I said in the previous slide, based on the definition, one goal of implementation research is to develop those reliable strategies or programs for implementing best practices, facilitating widespread adoption of those practices. The observational goal or category of implementation research is number two, generating insights and generalizable knowledge regarding those processes, barriers, facilitators, and so on. And as with any body of science, of course, implementation research aims to develop, test, and refine theories and hypotheses and methods and measures. So it's meant to be an interdisciplinary field that has all of the hallmarks or components of any form of research. Now, just to recap, the reason that implementation science is important to CER is the fact that the CER initiative, which aims to ultimately improve quality of care and outcomes and efficiency and effectiveness and so on, for that initiative to succeed, we need not just the $1.1 million worth of CER findings and reports, but in addition, we need them to be adopted and implemented. CER findings, as with most research findings, are not self-implementing, simply generating the results and publishing them and disseminating them widely, no matter how compelling they are and how obvious, is typically not sufficient to facilitate their implementation. We hear numbers like 17 years, which is the amount of time it takes on average for new research findings to be adopted. Whether that's accurate or not is subject to some controversy, but there are a number of the reports that I showed earlier, as well as considerable additional evidence demonstrating that research findings are not self-implementing. So the argument, of course, then, is that CER, to be effective, requires implementation, and CER implementation requires implementation research, the research to guide development and use of strategies to facilitate the adoption of CER findings. So that's part one. That's sort of the obvious way in which implementation science should enter CER in order to facilitate the achievement of CER goals. The second really builds on the first, and that is the argument that we should not simply be implementing the results of CER, but in fact studying implementation, in many cases at the same time that we're conducting the CER studies themselves. And let me talk you through this by beginning with this diagram. This is essentially an expansion of the simple pipeline. It begins with, in yellow, the basic science. Basic science then moves into clinical research. Translational preclinical research is basically translation type 1 animal research, computer research that's underway now to try to identify basic science findings that have some potential for a clinical value. In addition to clinical research, though, there are also fields of health behavior, health promotion research, and even HSR that generate new findings and innovations, effective treatments, care models, and so on. All of those need to be implemented. Ideally, we would follow the efficacy studies with effectiveness studies so that we not only know that something could work, but in fact that it does work in different kinds of settings. And it's the results of those effectiveness studies, as well as clinical practice guidelines and meta-analyses and other kinds of summaries, that then move into implementation research, which ultimately we hope will lead to what we're all after, which is improved health and outcomes. Now, this slide actually takes the right-hand portion of that pipeline and provides a bit of additional detail. So again, we have clinical health behavior and health services research, efficacy studies, the RCTs of new drugs and so on that are generating findings. Those ideally are followed by effectiveness studies as well as comparative effectiveness research. Those effectiveness studies in CER, along with results of the efficacy studies, lead to clinical practice guidelines, expert opinion and judgment enter as well. And it's the results of these studies, as well as the guidelines, that we are then trying to implement. Now, in addition to implementation research, or in some ways before implementation research, and by implementation research here, what I mean are trials and implementation strategies, computerized guidelines or computerized decision support, other kinds of strategies for implementing findings. Those kinds of studies ideally are preceded by research to document and diagnose quality gaps to understand where the new CER findings are being used or not being used, to diagnose those gaps and understand why it is that the findings are not being used, as well as observational studies of implementation. The field of implementation research for the most part tends to favor experimental studies and large trials, where we will, as I said, take a computerized reminder strategy and compare that to usual care. The problem with that research is that for the most part it fails. It doesn't succeed in achieving significant improvement. At the same time, though, that we within the VA, for example, are conducting our experimental evaluations of implementation, VA is implementing new practices all the time. The VA conducts many policy and practice initiatives to change care. The argument here is that researchers should be studying those naturally occurring implementation processes as another way of trying to generate insights and understanding regarding implementation. So the point is that all of these are different forms of implementation research and research activities that are needed so that we can move from these guidelines and the CDR findings to the desired health outcomes. And part of the implementation research portfolio needs to include these other types of studies. Now, why is that relevant to CDR? So the two bullets here state that the standard simplified pipeline basically separates effectiveness research and guideline development from implementation research. We conduct our CDR studies, we develop our guidelines, we hand them off, or more often, we throw them over the wall to the implementation researchers without any kind of interaction. And it's a problem, because the implementation research field has learned a fair amount about, for example, the ways in which guidelines should be developed and formatted and written to facilitate their implementation. We know that we need explicit language, we know that we need supportive tools, and so on. If we wait until a guideline is developed or until a CDR study is completed and then begin to think about implementation, it's a bit too late in some cases. So the argument in the second bullet is that effectiveness studies are in fact the place where we should begin to think about and study implementation. We can begin to document current practices, we can begin to diagnose quality gaps, and we can also begin to assess the likely acceptance and barriers and facilitators to use of CDR findings. So again, the idea is not to complete the CDR study, publish the results, and then turn to the implementation researchers, but instead invite the implementation researchers to participate in the CDR study design and conduct, and to begin to think about implementation and begin to gather evidence regarding implementation and the implementation barriers in the context of the CDR study itself. And there are actually at least, some work underway. I'm involved in a paper with some colleagues, and others we know are working on this as well, thinking about the concept, at least for now, that we're labeling hybrid effectiveness implementation studies. And I mean both standard effectiveness as well as comparative effectiveness. That in each case, that effectiveness research should be integrated with implementation, or perhaps better to say it the other way around, the implementation research should be integrated into the effectiveness. And here are at least three different types of hybrids. The first is a standard effectiveness trial, either comparing a new treatment to usual care or comparing two treatments, so a standard CDR study. If we begin to assess barriers and facilitators to adoption of the findings during that study, we're that much further along the way towards implementation. So that's one type of a hybrid. We could also include in our standard effectiveness trial specific targeted implementation activities in order to try to increase fidelity, increase use of the two treatments that we're comparing. And in this case, it's actually a form of a pilot study of an implementation strategy. If we feel that a computerized reminder or some continuous quality improvement type of practice change or other strategy is likely to be effective in increasing use of these novel treatments, then we include those implementation activities in the CDR study, and we collect data not only on effectiveness of the clinical treatments that we're comparing, but we collect data on the effectiveness of the implementation strategy and increasing use of those novel treatments. And then finally, further on the right, towards the right in the pipeline, there are studies that are actually implementation trials. We know that a certain treatment is effective. We know that we need to increase its use, so we are comparing a computerized reminder against an intensive behavior change, physician opinion leader type of strategy. At the same time, we could continue to collect the patient outcome data and continue to collect data on effectiveness. So it's a way, in this case, the comparative effectiveness are the primary goals of the study, and we're throwing in some implementation research at the same time. In the case of this third hybrid, it's the implementation research that's the primary goal of the study. But we are also at the same time collecting outcomes, patient outcome data, in order to continue to add to the comparative effectiveness or the effectiveness evidence base for the treatment that we're implementing. So two different kinds of questions. Is this clinical treatment effective? Is this implementation strategy effective? both can be examined at the same time through these different types of hybrids, and there are other hybrids as well. These are some of the major categories. Any questions about this before I go on?
Would number three include the following idea that there could be an intervention that's effective and has, you know, good for the patient and so forth, and then you'd have a way of monitoring the patient outcomes and so forth. But in assessing, you know, the value of that in implementation, you might run up in situations where not every patient necessarily wants to do what's being proposed, so that, you know, maybe the home run is 75% of the patients get the intervention as opposed to 90%. So where does that idea come in to sort of know what the real goal is in some of these interventions?
Yeah, I guess my view is that sort of situation is why we conduct effectiveness studies. That in a clinical efficacy study, the idea is, best case scenario, that we do encourage all patients to adhere to the protocol. Mm-hmm. Whereas in effectiveness, it's more of a sort of intent to treat kind of philosophy. That we go ahead and implement the new clinical program in a manner that allows the system to behave as it naturally would. And if there's clinician resistance or if there's patient resistance, then we allow for that. So in some ways, I suppose I would see that more as conventional CER rather than implementation research. Now, you could argue that patients should be given the freedom to do what they wish, but the clinicians in the health system should actually adhere to the program, to the protocol, so that in that kind of situation, if you suspect that fidelity on the part of the physicians is likely to be low, that you include the implementation activities and the more intensive efforts to encourage clinicians to adhere to the protocol.
Yeah, I was thinking about more from the point of view of the patient, so that it's, let's take mammography. Mm-hmm. So not all women want mammography. Okay, I don't know what the percentage is, but I know it's true. Mm-hmm. So if you set up some system to measure what is going on, and there's probably other examples where the maximal performance, in essence, would never be 100%. That's what I'm asking about. Where does that come in? Maybe it's your answer.
Sure. No, from my perspective, I would view that as sort of conventional CER. That's part of the philosophy of comparative effectiveness research. I don't know if others would agree with that. Mm-hmm. But that's one of the differences. So again, with an efficacy study, we go to great pains to try to encourage patients to take the medication as prescribed. Whereas with an effectiveness study, one of the questions you're interested in is, are the side effects and the complications of the dosage schedule and so on such that actual adherence is likely to be lower, and you allow patients to do what they wish.
So number three, if you could give some examples, I can think of one, but I'm not sure if it fits. I do a lot of research on complementary and alternative medicine, right, and there's some tremendous variations in provider skill level, for mm-hmm. example, massage. And you have a protocol to do massage in a particular way, and you train the people, but in the actual implementation of it, the skill differences play out. So you see the differences in outcomes. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure if that fits in with number three either.
Well, so if we go back to the separate phases, throw it over the wall sort of model, we used to talk in the VA query program about the fact that we don't develop evidence. We get evidence from other researchers, and the reason was that a lot of the query researchers were interested in doing clinical studies, the argument that they should be studying implementation, which they viewed as management consultation, not research, was a challenge. So in the simple model, the clinical studies are conducted prior to implementation research, and we as implementation researchers are not interested in measuring patient outcomes. If I'm conducting a pure, simple, streamlined implementation research, my main outcome measure is percent adherence to the clinical practice guideline, or percent of clinicians who are using the indicated therapy in a given situation. Whether using that indicated therapy improves patient outcomes is not a question that I'm interested in. If I'm implementing an evidence-based guideline or an evidence-based practice, basically I'm guaranteed to get the desired patient outcomes if I implement with higher fidelity that treatment. that's not always the case. And we, you know, ideally wouldn't wait until the clinical research is finished before we begin implementation. Typically, there's a need to continue to collect some of the effectiveness research. So these hybrid studies involve collecting and measuring patient outcomes and simultaneously determining whether an implementation strategy is effective in increasing fidelity and whether the underlying clinical treatment that we are pushing, that we are implementing, is effective. And in your case, it sounds like it's it could be a type 2 or a type 3 hybrid, depending on whether the major focus is on the implementation strategy. And obviously, the difference between 2 and 3 relates to issues of power, how you power the study, data collection resources. It can be expensive to collect the clinical outcomes. And that's one argument in favor of the simple implementation study where you measure adherence and don't worry at all about patient outcomes and just assume that they will improve with increasing adherence. But ideally, we would conduct, for the most part, these hybrids and would have the funding and the power to measure both outcomes.
So as I think about these and think about examples of, for example, the IOM has these lists of their, you know, priority studies, and I haven't looked at it for several months, but as I recall when I read like the top 25, what struck me was it's very much a case of comparing apples to oranges, where you have even something that is a drug versus a process measure would be actually almost the simplest, as I recall, on some of those. But is that part of your, did you have that in mind? Because it sounds actually just incredibly applicable in the sense of it would be almost, it seemed when I read through those again that it would be very challenging to determine the difference in some part of the clinical outcome versus the process.
That's related, and it's also, you know what? What I'd like to do is come back to that when I talk about my third role for implementation science,
okay,
because it's related to the question you're asking.
Okay.
So if I don't remember, ask again. But the answer generally is yes, it's related, but I'll show how with the third role. You have a question as well?
I answered it.
Okay. Those are the best kind. So this is the second role for implementation research, that we integrate implementation research activities into the CER studies themselves as a way of accelerating implementation. Let me conclude with just a couple of slides on the third role, and that again addresses your question, I hope, and that is applying implementation science principles to comparative effectiveness research on healthcare delivery systems and interventions. And actually, the list of 100 priorities that I have somewhere was classified according to broad categories. And first of all, the fourth priority says the effectiveness of dissemination and translation techniques, and here they're using translation where I would use implementation. Compare the effectiveness of dissemination translation techniques to facilitate the use of CER by patients, clinicians, payers, and others. So that's basically my role one. That is implementing a... But there are a number of other priorities that talk about delivery system interventions and comparison of different approaches to care that are not specific clinical treatments. The issue here is the fact that the basic CER approach in sort of philosophy assumes that our goal is to determine whether something works and which works better. So if we're talking about a straight effectiveness study, the question is, what's the effect size? If we're talking about a comparative effectiveness study, the question is, what is the effect size of strategy A versus strategy B? And when you think about policy and practice goals and the use of those research findings, basically, for the most part, we can think about formulary decisions. The question is this medication effective? And if so, should it be on the formulary? That's one sort of question, and that question works very well for clinical research and simple interventions like pills and surgical techniques and other kinds of simple interventions. And that's what most CER is all about. There's a second kind of question, though, and that is not does it work, but instead how, when, why, and where does it work? What are the kinds of factors, the contextual factors and others, that influence effectiveness? And the question now is not should I use it, but how should I use it? There's an extreme form of this argument that a couple of our colleagues in the UK published a few years ago, which basically says that in the field of quality improvement in healthcare or implementation research, in many cases, it doesn't matter much which QI intervention you use, which you select. It's a matter of how you use it. Now, that's equivalent to saying, if you have a patient with diabetes, it doesn't matter much which pill you use. The question is, how do you prescribe the pill? What other forms of diet and exercise and supporting kinds of therapies and so on? Now, obviously, when we're talking about clinical interventions, that argument doesn't make sense. We know that it does matter which pill you use, and we know that comparative effectiveness research can, for the most part, tell us which is better. Now, you know, in the era of personalized medicine, we're beginning to think more along the lines of which medications work for which patients under what circumstances, based on different genetic profiles and so on. The implementation field takes that personalized medicine perspective and argument and basically puts it as the primary question. It's not, does it work? To some extent, just about anything can work to change behavior of clinicians and organizations in delivering healthcare. The question is, how do you use it? What forms of senior management support and supportive therapies or activities are provided? What else is done? So, you know, I'm presenting the argument sort of in its extreme, but I think for the most part, much of the field of implementation research believes that argument to some extent. There are still a few who are often what I call the evidence-based medicine end of the spectrum. They take a very evidence-based medicine clinical research approach to implementation science, and they don't believe the underlying assumptions in approach number two. But many do. And the question here is, you know, to what extent should we be conducting impact-oriented research, trying to measure an effect size, and to assess the effectiveness of a given intervention, versus mechanism-oriented research, where the question is not does it work, but how. Let's understand the mechanisms of operation, the process of change. The reason that this debate is relevant to CER, and especially comparative effectiveness studies of delivery system interventions, is that these are, for the most part, complex social interventions. They're not simple interventions. They have many moving parts. They tend to be adapted and adopted. If you were studying a specific medication, you know, it may come in two or three doses, but that's about it. That's the extent of the degrees of freedom with which you can use that intervention. If you're talking about an organizational change program or a clinician behavior change program, typically you have many more degrees of freedom. There's a lot more that you can do to adopt and adapt that intervention. So again, the question is, how does it work? The other issue and the other argument that, again, is somewhat controversial, and I've had some debates with some of my evidence-based medicine-oriented colleagues, where I've argued that healthcare delivery systems and organizations tend to be more complex, with more moving parts, more heterogeneous, more changeable than the human body. And that for certain kinds of medications, we know that they operate more or less the same way. They're metabolized the same way within the 1,000 patients who happen to be participating in the study. So that it's reasonable to give all 1,000 patients the same medication and assume that 80% of them may benefit. Whereas with organizations, there's much more heterogeneity and variability. And it's more necessary for us to adapt the specific behavior change program or intervention. So if, and as a consequence, the second bullet, you know, states that there's no inherent property of effectiveness. We can't measure or estimate the effectiveness or effect size of that behavior change or implementation or quality improvement intervention. It basically varies so widely across different settings and contexts that there's no single number that we can estimate. So there are obviously a number of implications of this, one of which is the concept of meta-analysis has somewhat limited value in implementation. If we pool the results of 10 different studies of a drug, if we believe there's a certain amount of stability and homogeneity, those 10 studies are likely to be comparable, and it makes sense for us to combine the results. If we try to pool 10 different studies of an organization change program, and the study samples are very different, and the individuals who were delivering the organization change program were different, and so on, then pooling those is not likely to be very valuable. We're likely to see much broader confidence intervals and much less stability in our estimates over time. So that's related to the second point, that there's no inherent property of effectiveness that we can estimate through repeated study. So the basic argument here is captured in the bottom bullet, that when we conduct comparative effectiveness research on delivery system interventions and other complex social interventions, that we should not be designing, conducting those studies in the way that we would CDR studies of drugs and other simple interventions and clinical treatments, but instead we should be using implementation science approaches. We should be emphasizing the process and process evaluation, not a black box impact evaluation. We should be examining those mechanisms rather than trying to estimate effectiveness, and we should be paying a lot of attention to contextual factors. So this is the third and final way in which implementation science, I would assert, has a role to play in CDR, in ways in which implementation science is critical for the achievement of CDR goals. So let me stop there and turn to any other questions.
There's a rich history in sociology of studying many of these processes, systems, and it brings to my mind the debates between theoretical and applied sociology. And looking specifically at point two, you say there's no inherent property of effectiveness that can be estimated. I know that you're interested in theories and generalizability. What's being generalized?
What's being generalized in my mind are the principles. So what we're trying to determine or produce through CDR studies of delivery system interventions or through implementation studies, what we're trying to produce are theories and principles, sort of recurrent patterns of behavior. So for example, the idea that senior management leadership support is important. That's something that we hope to learn through implementation science, and that's not a very good example because it's something that's well known and well established. But there are a number of other principles like that. So the idea, for example, that clinicians tend to respond somewhat less to information and evidence than they do to professional norms and peer influence. When you go through medical school and your training, what tends to be somewhat more effective in ultimately determining how you practice is not necessarily what you read in the journals or in the textbooks, but instead what your mentors do. So you finish your degree and you go into an internship residency and you're in hospital A on the east side, and they say that treatment X is by far better than treatment Y. That's the way we do things around here. You go through your next rotation in the other hospital on the other side of town, and it's the opposite. The norms at that institution are the treatment Y is better than treatment X. The evidence may be controversial and inconclusive, but they're very strong norms. So again, that's an example of sort of an underlying principle of behavior of clinicians and healthcare delivery systems that implementation research should be sort of surfacing and developing, and that's what we should be using as a way of making decisions. So, and actually that latter point is important, and there's a slide that I use in some of my talks that I'm not using here, which talks about what it is that the field should be generating. It's basically a version of your question. If the goal of clinical research is to generate the effect size findings that can then be pulled in a meta-analysis, and it's that formulary decision and that pulled effect size that the clinician should be using to make a judgment about whether or not to prescribe a drug, the kinds of decisions that healthcare leaders make and clinical leaders who are trying to improve quality and change in practice can't be made on the basis of numbers. Instead, they need to be made on the basis of some combination of internalized principles and understandings of organizational behavior and professional behavior, some level of evidence as to what seems to work under what circumstances or not. But ultimately, it's a set of decisions that involve too many factors to have those decisions be made in sort of a rational, calculated manner. Now, we tend to make decisions about managing organizations and people in the same way that we make decisions about raising our kids. Now, you can read one study that strong discipline is the key to success, whereas in another study, you're supposed to give the kids the freedom to make their own mistakes. There is no evidence-based approach to raising kids. There's some research, there are principles, there's intuition that you develop over time. So when I try to teach management and leadership in MBA programs and so on, I try to teach the basic principles. But I also make it very clear that a good leader is one who develops over time. So you begin armed with those principles, and then you operate, you lead, and you see how the audience, your targets, respond to you. And that allows you to refine your own internal judgment. So it's a problem, though, because for research to generate knowledge to support that kind of decision-making is not exactly what we like to think of in terms of good, solid, rigorous research in the form of clinical trials and so on. And in some ways, I guess another principle that I've observed over the years is that a good implementation researcher is not one who studies hard, but instead one who's led one or two projects and failed in a big way, but ideally in a way that involved active involvement in actually leading the project. And so that allows you as a project leader to not only apply the principles and the evidence that you've read, but also to apply your own learning and experience. So it's definitely a mixture of the art and science of implementation with more art than science. And I personally don't think that we'll ever have evidence-based management the same way that we'll have evidence-based medicine. And that has implications for these kinds of studies. Yes?
I think it strikes me that implementation doesn't only cost money. And that's something that you kind of alluded to earlier with NIH. But if what we're generalizing is really the principles of implementation science, it seems like the NIH in its mission is really interested in generalizing, kind of research findings, et cetera. Do you feel like the reimbursement structure that we have in our healthcare system, and it may be changing in the future, who knows, but do you think that on the ground in delivery systems, in community hospitals and community clinics, et cetera, do you think the reimbursement structure exists to support the dissemination of these principles beyond implementation research, NIH-funded research?
Yeah, I think so. I think that among the principles are, so one argument in the field is that implementation requires a series of necessary but not sufficient conditions or intervention elements. That for physicians to adopt a new practice requires good evidence, and it has to be legitimate and professionally accepted. A good clinical practice guideline, meaning guideline that was developed by the specialty society, not by an insurance company. It requires a sort of audit and feedback, evidence of current practice. So if you present clinicians with an evidence-based guideline that they accept, chances are the response will be, yes, I agree that that's the right way to practice, and I practice that way. Whereas if you provide them with evidence showing that they practice that way perhaps 50% of the time, their motivation to implement the guideline, to change their practice, will be higher. It also requires external interest and scrutiny. So if I know as a clinician that my practices are monitored and that I will receive a report every month, and that my department chair will also receive a report, and if I believe in the validity of the data and the findings in the report, that too adds to the motivation. So these are the kinds of findings that I think NIH research should generate and should produce. And I think the practice and policy community should be made aware of them. And I think there are ways of changing reimbursement rules and regulations and other things that will facilitate this kind of implementation and the use and application of the knowledge from this research. So even though it's different, we're not talking about formulary decisions and effect sizes, I think there's still a role for NIH-funded research, publication dissemination. But again, it's not a matter of having the clinical leaders read the articles. They need to actively practice these procedures and these principles in order to gain the skills and the knowledge that they need.
Is the notion in the implementation of science that you're studying a delivery system as opposed to an individual provider?
I think it's all of the above. I think it's both. I think for the most part, it also depends in part on what sort of system we're talking about. So there are relatively few sort of social psychological types of studies within the VA focusing on individual clinicians, because for the most part it's an organized delivery system, and we know that the individual clinicians will respond to organizational and system factors. So we tend to operate on the system itself. But generally speaking, the field of management organization behavior is based on social psychology, sociology, economics, political science, and so on. So I think all of those disciplines and all of those principles and ways of thinking and studying do come into play and are part of the implementation something.
Okay, actually, that was another question. I was going to ask that question. Okay. So because I've read a lot of what you might call books about influence. I use that terminology, which definitely comes from social psychology,
sure.
And it's used a lot in improving clinician behavior.
Right.
And so that's also part of what
yes,
we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, that is a part of it. But again, from my perspective, that is a part, but not all of it.
Yeah.
And that we need the other supportive system elements, and think about group behavior as well as individual behavior.
Right. And another, I was
throw this out, I don't know if it's really that relevant, but you know, people are interested in ways of measuring or quantifying how well large delivery systems are, quote, doing, and you know, beyond the HEDIS measure or something. And is that part of what this would be, figuring out ways to sort of grade, if you will, a delivery system in terms of its workings? Is there, I mean, I don't even know what I'm really suggesting, sure. Just the idea of it.
Yeah, there's sort of, you know, there's a focus within the field on implementation outcomes and how to measure those. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's an area of some controversy and ongoing development because there isn't complete agreement. So if you talk about implementing a guideline, for example, do you achieve implementation of a guideline if adherence is high, even if most of the clinicians don't even know the existence of the guideline? Or do you achieve implementation of a guideline if you've put in place certain organizational policies and procedures that explicitly focus on guideline recommendations? Those are different kinds of outcomes. So the field does, in fact, as part of its methods and measures development component, focus on trying to identify and define and conceptualize those kinds of outcomes, which can be used for monitoring the results of implementation. Yes?
You, in answer to my earlier question, you spoke about the importance of art, you know, as well as science.
Sure.
But the title is Implementation Science, as if there's no art.
Yeah, I guess to me, I would like to see art as you know, this idea of principles. That you know, we need to be a good leader, to be a good parent, you need intuition. But ideally, that intuition would be driven by you know, underlying principles in some education. So you know, I'd much rather you know, me as a parent and my parents not sort of take an experimental approach from day one, but instead start with some good basic training and education. And then try some things, and know that they need to experiment with different levels of discipline, for example, and tight control to see what works for that given that kid. So again, it's I think art that does have a ideally generalizable and a scientific basis. I should stop here. If there are any other questions, I can handle them individually. But thanks to all of you for your participation and questions.